superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
Hunting, fishing, and gathering has always been something that we did.
A half century ago, a court decision affirmed Native American fishing rights on Lake Superior.
Their treaty rights, we do have them protected or we don't, and let's get it into the court system.
We'll hear the story behind it and another landmark ruling and celebrations of them both. Plus, they're an Americana rock band known for their unique perspective on the human experience. We'll catch up with Janie and the Spokes. And the winter that wasn't is almost over. What did it mean for businesses that depend on the snow? Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Tonight, Friday, March 8th, the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians will be celebrating 50 years of the Gurnall decision, the court case from the 1970s that affirmed Native American fishing rights on Lake Superior. Last fall, both tribal governments and the state marked the 40th anniversary of a similar landmark case upholding Native hunting and fishing rights throughout the area. The celebration of the Gurnall decision takes place at 7 p.m. tonight at the Legendary Waters Resort in Bayfield. For background on the case, here are Red Cliff Band members Rose Gurnall and Ron DePerry in Lifting the Nets, a presentation produced by the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission.
I really don't have a lot of memories. I was only 9 years old at the time. It wasn't until later in my life I finally learned the significance of the Gurnall decision. There was a question whether we were able to fish in Lake Superior according to the treaty. They were saying that we had to fish inland. If you look at Red Cliff, we have maybe one river and a couple little streams. How would we subsist on something like that? You have to go back to how did the people that negotiated the treaty. What was the intent? And that was, of course, to fish in Lake Superior. My father's name was on the decision itself, but it involved seven other people.
I had just gotten out of the military service. I had been drawing unemployment, maybe kind of also looking for work. But if you look back and reflect back to that time period of 1969, what was happening was that Indian men in particular were being arrested for hunting, fishing, and gathering. I mean, it was story after story, not only here in Red Cliff, but throughout Indian country where that was happening. It just wasn't being arrested. There was fines. You had to go to jail. Your whole family probably didn't eat. Hunting, fishing, and gathering has always been something that we did. And so what else could you do? How long can this go on? Take it to the next level and say, hey, look, their treaty rights, we do have them protected or we don't, and let's get it into the court system. Let them decide. And so we said, well, let's do a test case. Let's set a gill net and do a test for the fishing. Then we began to get more serious about planning it out, try to figure out who would be wanting or willing to do this. Our thoughts then was to say, well, let's go ahead and let the newspapers know, the Ashland Daily Press, the Duluth News Tribune, Channel 3, 6, and 10, let them all know. In fact, even let the game wardens know that this is what we're going to do on such and such a time and date. That's what we're going to do. So we went down, we set our net off the campground. At 9 or 10 o'clock the next morning, people began to gather at the landing. Even commercial fishermen that were non-Indian from Bayfield. Lots of tribal members and elders. We got out there in the water and we started the lift. Uncle Butts Peterson, Dick Gurnall, and Philip Gordon were in one boat. Alan Bear and Roger Basney and myself were in another boat. And so as we began to go out and lift, the game wardens were then already coming toward us over from the Royce Point area. He said, well, here they come now. And Philip Gordon, he lifted, and the first big thing that came out was a big sucker. And when he held it up, everybody was cheering all over. They were just yelling and screaming, and oh my goodness. the game wardens were right there by us with a loudspeaker. And they says, you guys, you're arrested. And so we come on board, and there were cheers from the shoreline and saying, well, where are they taking you? I said, well, we're going to Washburn, Bayfield County. We're going to be charged. However long it took to go through the court system until the final result was that it is a treaty-protected right, and the decision was final. Hunting and fishing, gathering, treaty rights protected.
It's really important because fishing has gone on Lake Superior since, I think, the 16th or 17th century. With the migration of the tribes, we all ended up in La Pointe. It was just part of our whole life. I just hope that we're able to continue that tradition. I don't think it'll ever die out, I don't.
That was Rose Gurnow and Ron DePerry in Lifting the Nets, presentation about the Gurnow decision, produced by the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. A celebration of the decision takes place at 7 p.m. tonight, Friday, March 8th, at the Legendary Waters Resort in Bayfield. Last fall, Northern Wisconsin tribes and the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission held a similar celebration for the 40th anniversary of the federal Voight decision, which upheld tribal fishing rights throughout the region. I spoke with Ann McCammon-Soltis, the Commission's Director of Intergovernmental Affairs, and its Executive Administrator, Jason Schlender. Here's our conversation from back then, preceded by a backgrounder on the federal case. Fishing is a way of life in northern Wisconsin, and it has been for centuries among Ojibwe people. That continued long after European contact, with native anglers harvesting fish on both tribal lands after reservations were created in the 1800s and elsewhere. Their rights to hunt and fish outside those boundaries were upheld 40 years ago by the United States Court of Appeals. But not everyone respected that decision, and tribal members faced harassment from non-native fishermen who complained that the decision would diminish the fish population available to them. Those actions became known as the Walleye Wars, punctuated by unfortunate and blatantly racist incidents. Thankfully, that's largely in the past, although issues around harvesting quotas and environmental concerns do persist. Last week, tribal members celebrated the anniversary of the ruling. Here with us to mark it today are Ann McCammon-Soltis, Director of the Division of Intergovernmental Affairs for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and Jason Schlender, the Commission's Executive Administrator. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Ann and Jason.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So first of all, is the anniversary a celebration or commemoration since so much adversity happened after the court decision was handed down? And?
Well, I think it really is a celebration because even though there was, as you say, a lot of controversy and a lot of protests that followed, this was something that tribal members knew they had the right to do for many, many years. And they had been cited by the state of Wisconsin over and over when all they were doing was simply exercising the rights that they knew they had reserved in these treaties. So they were celebrating the fact that a federal court also recognized that these rights continued to exist.
Mm-hmm. Jason, can you give us a little bit about the history leading to the ruling?
Yeah, so for a long time, leading up to their incident in 1974, tribal members from many parts of Wisconsin, you know, were harassed by law enforcement or having their harvest activities hindered by a misconception of what tribal members believe and know to believe to be true is their ability to hunt, fish, and gather on the ceded territories that their ancestors designated in treaties signed a long time ago. And so there's a number of different stories, a number of different things that we know as tribal members of law enforcement confiscating not only the, you know, the things, the animals that they harvested, but also their tools in which they were using to harvest were taken from them. and sometimes they were incarcerated too. So Mike and Fred Tribble, both of them are their brothers. They're from the Lac-Courtier Reservation. In order to bring that issue into court, they had to be cited. And so what they did was they were informed by this guy, his name was Larry Leventhal, to put together a test case. So they went out on this place called Chief Lake, which is outside of our reservation in Lac-Courtier. I'm from Lac-Courtier too. And there's an imaginary line that divides Chief Lake right in half. One part's on reservation, the other part is off reservation. And both Fred and Mike set up their fish shack during the wintertime to spear through the ice. So when that happened and they were cited by the game warden, and they were cited for harvesting off the reservation.
I would take it that they had to have a lot of intestinal fortitude to go through with this, right? You don't just say, you know, well, I'm just going to go fish over the imaginary line and see what happens, right? I mean, they have to be prepared for, they had to be prepared for all sorts of adversity.
Well, I think, too, that you have to think of the context of that time. So 1974, both Mike and Fred were involved in the American Indian Movement, which is a civil rights. And so they were motivated by what was happening in society. So there was a lot of things that were kind of happening in society. This is all your post-civil rights stuff, including movements by Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, and with a lot of with African-American people in this country. And it kind of reverberated out into other other ethnic groups in this country. Instead of just not doing anything, they had to do something. So,
and that something eventually led to the victory at the federal court. I might make an analogy to other, you know, major rulings, civil rights rulings like Brown versus Board of Education. What would have happened if the ruling hadn't been made? I don't want to concentrate on this alternative universe that I'm painting here, and thank goodness it's not there. Anne?
You know, I think in that alternate universe, tribal members would have a more difficult time sustaining themselves. A lot of the harvest that takes place off the reservation goes to feed members of the community. And, you know, if tribes didn't have that opportunity, those community members would have to be sustained in a different way. So I think this allows the tribes to continue their life way as much as they can, as they had in the past.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Anne McCammon-Soltis, Director of the Division of Intergovernmental Affairs for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and Jason Schlender, the Commission's Executive Administrator. We're talking about the 40th anniversary of the federal court decision upholding native fishing and hunting rights. Last week's commemoration included Governor Tony Evers, and he said work still remains to, quote, uphold the rights and call out anti-native hate and racism, close quote. Let's take a listen to some of his remarks.
This is a celebration. Celebrate the 40th anniversary of Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, GLIFWIC, and the that landmark decision that I still remember to this day, that landmark decision that secured Ojibwe rights, the people, Ojibwe people's right to hunt and fish on their ceded land. You know, that it's amazing it took, you know, decades and decades and decades to come to that conclusion when everybody knew that that's exactly what the way it was supposed to be. It's important for me to be here today to celebrate and thank you for the partnership and all the things that you do. You know, our indigenous neighbors and communities have called Wisconsin home since time immemorial, well before we became a state. And for centuries, Ojibwe people have been hunting and gathering from the land and waterways to provide for their communities and also to preserve their rich cultural traditions. So it's our responsibility to uphold these rights and treaties, protect against harvesting harassment, and call out anti-Native hate and racism when we hear it and see it.
And that again was Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers speaking at the celebration last week of Northern Wisconsin Tribes and the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, or GLIFWIC, marking the 40th anniversary of the federal court's Voight decision upholding tribal fishing rights. So again, Governor Evers said work still needs to be done. Anne, what are some areas you think need to be addressed today?
Well, there are a lot of challenges, I think, facing the natural resources that are the subject of the treaty right. We at GLIFWIC have been doing quite a bit of work looking at the vulnerability of various species or beings to climate change. And we found that some of the really important beings that the tribes rely on, like wild rice, are vulnerable to climate change. And so one of the things we've been thinking very much about is how do we work with our member tribes to try and make sure that wild rice continues to be on the landscape for the future? You know, non-native beings, beings who were brought here from another country, are another challenge that we face. So, there are a lot of things that are affecting the natural resources that we need to focus on.
Mm-hmm. On the human angle of it, the governor spoke directly about persistent racism. I'm going to ask the most Pollyannish question I probably can, but do you think it ever can be solved?
Well, I think we have to have hope. You know, we have to be hopeful and optimistic that that relationships between human beings will continue to evolve and to get better. And so I think that it comes through education. It comes through a shared experience and sharing those experiences. And that's what you saw there at that event, was an opportunity for people to share their experiences, whether they were good or bad, and to realize that that we're all in this together. It's a celebration for ourselves as an organization, and with our member tribes and our constituents and our partners, but also realizing that, you know, the education never ends. And so when I think of, like, when the decision was handed down and information about it was disseminated, you know, through different media outlets, how that was misinterpreted, oftentimes that led to ignorance and misconceptions. And now, over the last 40 years, we've done a lot as an organization to assist, you know, really bolstering the education, our educational efforts to help people understand not only what treaty rights are, but to also understand some of the concerns that we have as an organization, also on behalf of our member tribes, of the vulnerability, as Anne had mentioned, of some of the, you know, real issues that can and will impact the resource that that we all have in common.
Mm-hmm. What's your message to non-native sport fishing and hunting groups, kind of along the lines of what you were just talking about, Jason?
My message would be is that I hope we all have an understanding of that the resources that are available to us can be exhausted. And so I think cooperation and collaboration is helpful for us to understand that through those measures of collaboration and cooperation, that whatever it is their mission is to celebrate the resource, that we support them. But at the same time, we have an obligation to also look after the resource and to carry out our tribe's sovereign capacity to practice their treaty rights as well. That, you know, that there's a collective understanding there as well. So
right. And by the way, there's no reason these groups shouldn't and don't include Native members, correct? I assume they do. They just happen not to be led by Native people.
Yeah, I would think it's difficult when you think of these special interest groups. They're all unique. They all have their own, you know, their own mission, their own directives. And so I think it's hard. It's difficult to kind of to compartmentalize them.
Or even stereotype them, right, yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's fair to just encourage them to cooperate, you know, and to collaborate, because we have a lot of information, we have a lot of experience and a lot of resources that we can use for them to maximize what it is that they're trying to do, but also realize that if we work together, I think it helps reduce the tendency for tribal members and other people being injured or harmed by misconceptions and stereotypes. And so as we're discussing it, I'm thinking of different groups. And I don't feel like I'm excluded. It's just a matter of how I want to engage, if I believe it's a benefit to participate or not.
Mm-hmm. In the spirit of the celebration, I want to end on a positive note. There's been no shortage of media coverage of the unfortunate incidents in the aftermath of the decision. But what's the most enlightening story you've heard in the 40 years since and leading up to today?
At the event, there were a number of different people that were there to celebrate with us. That back in 1983, when the decision came out, would not have been there.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of, I think, initial misconceptions and animosity and ignorance. And so over time, through education and through getting to know your partners and to getting to know and educating yourself or and others, the relationships have been cultivated and reinforced over time. So what I am happy about is that some of our agency partners were there to celebrate with us, because the celebration wasn't just for tribal members only. Everyone was invited to participate, and the people that did, they were there to reflect. So there was some kind of rehashing of things that happened in the past. So there were some tears that were shed, but not always tears of pain. It was just kind of a celebration of where we are now and being able to kind of celebrate our accomplishments collectively. And so that's what I look at. And I mentioned this as well, is that from a personal standpoint, a lot of us as Indigenous people, we strive to not lose our identity. That's a big thing for many of us. We do these things, we harvest, and we continue to practice our treaty rights so that we may always be recognizable to our ancestors. And that's what I'm proud of as well.
Mm-hmm. Anne, anything to add to that?
Well, I think going back to what Jason said about, you know, collaboration, you know, my mind goes back to an event we had some years ago, celebrating the 20th anniversary of Gliflec. And we had some folks from the state who were participating, and they talked about the fact that because the tribes have these treaty rights, we now take better care of the resources in the ceded territory. We manage better because it is a shared resource. And you know, I find that to be a very hopeful thing, that we can continue to work with our partners and do better by the resource than we would if any one party was trying to do management alone.
All right. We've been speaking with Anne McCammon-Soltis, Director of the Division of Intergovernmental Affairs for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and Jason Schlender, the Commission's Executive Administrator. Thank you for joining us, Anne and Jason.
You're very welcome.
That was my conversation from last October with officials from the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission on the 40th anniversary of the federal VOIT decision that upheld tribal fishing rights throughout the region. Coming up, they're a band whose members have a common interest in bicycling. We'll catch up with Janie and the Spokes. Thank you. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Janie and the Spokes is an Americana rock band playing original music in a collaborative four-piece band. Their music is written by Jane Ulse, who's on vocals and guitar, and Garth Anderson, who's their drummer. Collaborating with them are Peter Ulse on lead guitar and mandolin, and Jordan Ash on bass. Their music has been described as alternative and edgy and drawing you in with a unique perspective on the human experience. Their albums include Eclipse and Dead Eye Rust, and they join me now. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Janie and the Spokes.
Thank you very much.
And we've got all the Spokes there, right?
We do. We have all the Spokes here, myself, my husband, Peter Ulse. We have Garth Anderson, who is also the songwriter. And we have Jordan Ash, who is our bass player. And also, we call him our dog whisperer. Although we no longer have a dog to whisper to. So.
I'll keep that in mind if I find a dog that needs whispering to.
Yeah.
So I frequently start out these interviews by asking about your band's name, and I want to do that, but I'm going to hold off for a bit, and I want you to put Peter a 2-4 there because, first of all, Peter, you're a physician, and when I first returned to the area 20 years ago, somebody gave me a list of healthcare providers to choose from, and your name was first because it's spelled AAS. So are you always at the front of the line?
Well, alphabetically, yes. As far as other situations in life, I wouldn't say so, no.
Well, I bring it up because it is a memorable name, and listeners may not have realized how to spell it, A-A-S, again, due to its pronunciation, O-S. Jane, you married into this name, so the origin of it?
Peter's family is from Denmark, so two A's in the Danish language sounds like an O.
All right, that's easy enough. So, how about Janie and the Spokes? We know who Janie is. What does the Spokes refer to?
Well, as our band was kind of forming, it seemed like everybody that we were playing with was really into bike riding. And so being that we were all kind of enjoying riding our bikes, we kind of made these jokes about having interchangeable spokes because we've had so many people jump in over the years. we just kind of settled on Janie and the Spokes. And yeah, that's pretty much it. Too deep.
Well, you could do like, little kids do and put a balloon or something on your spokes to make some music, perhaps, some percussion sounds. Yeah.
Or some big popping noises.
Well, that leads into your training as musicians. What's the background of each of you?
Well, for myself, my parents bought me a guitar when I was 11 years old. And so I started learning on my own and have basically been self-taught. And when I went off to college in 84 to UMD, I met other kids my age that were also kind of plunking around on the guitar. And over time, more songs kind of came together and jam sessions and campfires and camping. And so kind of that's how the guitar playing started. But then, of course, when I met Peter, he really helped me with more skills, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Peter, your musical training?
My mom signed me up for piano lessons for a few years when I was young, and I plunked around with that. But when I was 15, I convinced my dad to buy me a guitar for my birthday, and it just drew me in. And I've made great friends with other people playing over the years. I've been in bands on and off my entire life, and a couple that were sort of original, even recorded an album of original music when I was in college. But I was the guy that was mixed the absolute lowest in the mix of the whole album. So since then, and I picked up some banjo and some mandolin and some bass, and can kind of plunk around on most stringed instruments.
Mm-hmm. Garth, your musical background?
I'm a drummer for the most part, and I do a little songwriting. I've got some things posted on Bandcamp under Garth Anderson, if anybody's interested. Just picked it up along the way.
When did you get your first drum set?
Oh, probably when I was 10 years old for Christmas, and sort of made a career out of it. I was a band director for a few years, and have always played music, lots of cover band stuff through the years. I think when I was in my 20s, that's all I did. That's all the landscape was in in Jamestown, North Dakota, Fargo, North Dakota, the thought of doing originals was not even on the map. That's what I want to do, is play original music.
Mm-hmm. Jordan, your background, were you classically trained on that bass or what?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. Nope. I started playing guitar in sixth grade. And then for a while, I was one of the only kids who played guitar. So I had lots of opportunities to play in rock bands. And then other people started playing guitar and they were all much better than I was. So I realized nobody played bass and I switched to bass.
That happens a lot with bass players, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's hear something. How about Hit or Miss? Janie, that's got you down as the songwriter. Can you set that up for us?
Sure. Actually, this was one of my more serious songs, kind of about a relationship that is struggling and you're wondering how to help someone that is in pain and just trying to stay in touch with them, but really not sure if they're okay or not okay.
All right, well, here is Hit or Miss by Janie and the Spokes.
Calling
And that was Hit or Miss by Janie and the Spokes. They'll be appearing at Earthrider Brewery in Superior tomorrow, March 9th at 8:30 p.m. as part of the Earthrider Bockfest. And I have to say, you know, ever since President Biden visited there, I wonder if you have to have a security clearance to get in.
They probably would for us. better check those guys, right?
Well, we first met earlier this year at Duluth Does Elton John at Sacred Heart Music Center, which we also ran on the show here. And first of all, the group performed Benny and the Jets, and Jane, you accentuated that by wearing real live electric boots.
So. I did. And you know what? Peter, before we got on stage, he goes, "You're going to get electrocuted." And I thought, oh, no. And then by the time I actually walked to the microphone, I only had one electric boot. So I kept singing, you know, that line, and I'm thinking, my electric boot. So that was kind of funny. But, you know, that's part of the wardrobe malfunction that artists really have to worry about.
Well, it goes for us MCs, too, because we were struggling, Laura Lee and me, with our boas and Elton John glasses, too. So that's, I didn't notice the one boot thing.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, Garth, how much do you do of covers? And when you do them, do you approach them differently than you do your own work?
You know, we've got a few covers when we play out live, and I think that we approach them as trying to be authentic to the recording as much as we can. And I think it's really good for us to learn other people's music. That being said, most of the time we're working on our original songs, and I'm fortunate that I'm able to contribute that. And this group has, I feel real fortunate that they've allowed me to bring in songs, and then the group really works with it and reworks it.
Well, one of your offerings is Sunshine Hammer. Can you set that one up for us?
I'd love to. There was a recording that sort of sent me on the path from drummer to songwriter, and I started getting more into guitar and writing songs. And that was a cassette that I had Bob Dylan, the Motel tapes, this touchstone of music before Bob Dylan became famous. And he's mostly doing covers. And the reason I mention this is there's a song on there. It's an old folk song called Stealing. And the first line in that song is, "Well, put your arms around me like a circle around the sun. Stay with me, darling." And well, as we all know, we kind of borrow from things. And that's where I got the first line for Sunshine Hammer. Put your arms around me like a circle around the sun. I just out and out stole that, as Bob Dylan stole that. The song started out as a waltz, and I brought it to the band, and we've kind of reworked it, and I really like it a lot better after what the band did to it. Enough of my yakking. Let's play it.
All right. Here is Sunshine Hammer by Janie and the Spokes.
Behind sunshine hammer.
Sunshine Hammer by Janie and the Spokes. They'll be appearing at Earth Rider Brewery in Superior tomorrow, March 9th at 8:30 p.m. Where can we learn more about your music? Jordan, can you tell us?
It's on Bandcamp. Search for Janie and the Spokes. Both of our albums are on there. And then also on Facebook, also Janie and the Spokes.
All right. How about one more to take us out? Eclipse, which is the title track from your latest album?
Yes, I wrote last year, kind of around the annular eclipse. It was around October 14th, I think. And actually, my brother drove down to Texas and took the cover photo for the CD. So that was kind of fun. But the song is really about kind of looking at a changing relationship and really not, you know, being uncertain if things are better or worse, just not knowing, but kind of looking through a veil, and the eclipse is setting the backdrop for the song.
Perfect, especially for those of us who somehow missed it.
Yes.
Well, we've been speaking with Janie and the Spokes. They'll be appearing at Earth Rider Brewery in Superior tomorrow, March 9th at 8:30 p.m. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. So have you been enjoying the winter that wasn't? The warmer temperatures in our region have come at the cost of curtailed winter sports, That includes a canceled snowshoeing trek I wanted to go on, and it's been a particular challenge for businesses that depend on the snow. WPR's Danielle Kading has this report.
As the sun shone overhead, blinding white snow blanketed the course at the start of the American Birkebeiner ski race. Temperatures hovered below freezing, and hundreds of skiers and spectators waited for the starting gun at the 50th anniversary of North America's largest cross-country ski race. But if it weren't for artificial snow, it's likely the race would have never happened. Organizers announced in early February that the Berkey would be held on a shorter course and on snow they made themselves.
Pretty amazing that we have no snow otherwise and they were able to still pull off this race.
That's 44-year-old Ann Nischke of Stevens Point. She cheered on elite skiers as they raced laps on a 10-kilometer course and cable. Nischke skied a shorter race the day before. She says even that was tough.
Well, like this year, I didn't train at all.
She switched to running to train for the race, and so did 18-year-old Laura Johnson of Madison. She was waiting to ski a shorter version of the Berkey. While she's glad the event took place, she says it wasn't the same this year.
Because it's not the full thing, and like, I really enjoy going into Hayward and finishing up in the middle of the street.
Some skiers say artificial snow made the course icy and difficult to navigate. Others say it created faster conditions and praised organizers for pulling off the race. But 64-year-old Rich Montana of Amory was just glad the event happened at all.
Thank God there's man-made snow.
About a 20-minute drive away in downtown Hayward, people are shopping at businesses like Riverbrook Bike and Ski. Cindy Smith-Kaner co-owns the shop. She says the lack of snow means ski sales have been almost non-existent, and many businesses are saying revenues are down 75%.
We're just looking ahead. I don't want to dwell on that number. Just think to the future, and I think it makes you be more conservative and diversified.
Hotels, lodges, and restaurants have missed out on customers who usually come up to ski, snowmobile, and ice fish. That's according to Chris Ruckdashel with the Hayward Area Chamber of Commerce. He says some businesses have reported losses of hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's prompted the chamber to promote the use of ATVs instead.
It's helped a lot. It just hasn't completely replaced what otherwise would have been.
Not all businesses say the warm winter is hurting their bottom line.
And then she's going to do a glass of Prosecco.
Caroline Gertis with Three Fly Sisters Taps and Wines says some people have been more willing to get out of their homes with the warmer weather.
You know, despite the no snow, we've been extremely busy. I think because we're not dependent on that snowmobile traffic and we're right in town, everyone's shopping and doing fun things.
At Myers Beach on Lake Superior, ice melts in the midday sun along the shoreline before giving way to open water. A decade ago, almost 150,000 people visited here to see the ice caves within the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. The ice caves haven't been open to the public since 2015. This year, Neil Schrader of Washburn saw the massive ice formations from a kayak.
Big chunks of ice, goes some 30 feet long, and then little tiny icicles inside the caves and on things, and from the water splashing up against it. It was just a real beautiful, surreal kind of experience.
Schrader has paddled to the caves a couple times this winter, but he warned it's dangerous. An emergency room physician, he says people could die within seconds if they fall in the icy waters. While he enjoys winter paddling, he says the warmer weather has been kind of a bummer.
But, you know, you have to kind of adapt. Go running, go kayaking, do other things.
Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. We leave you with more of the music of Janie and the Spokes. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
We've got so many.